The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine, Thursday, September 21. How are you all keeping out there? I hope you're doing very well indeed. And we have another busy one for you. Another 3 hours of entertainment, information, and whatever you want to talk about as well. We want you involved in the conversation. To raise your issues, comment on what we've got lined up for you. We'll be covering all the stories I think you might expect us to. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts that number. And feel free, by the way, if you want to send a voice note to that number, 086 60 25000. If you want to give us a call, it's 074 91 25000 91 25000, and your emails come into us at comments@highlandradio.com. And you can watch the show live, as you can every single day, of course, on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. Good morning to you. If you've joined us there, you can watch on your big TV, your smart TV, your Fire Stick, or any of your devices. And on Facebook, it's Highland Hub or Highland Radio News and Sport. And loads of papers out, as it is a Thursday morning, of course. And we'll start with this morning's Tyrconnell Tribune. MICA scheme adding to people's distress. That was the message coming out loud and clear from the MICA meeting at the Rye Community Centre on Tuesday night. A big crowd had packed into the room long before the meeting began, and Lisa Hone, chairperson of the Donegal MICA Action Group, said the lack of political drive is simply unacceptable. One of the hot issues on the night is the snail's pace of progress by Donegal County Council in processing MICA redress payments amid claims that contractors have had to walk away from property not fully finished because not one red cent has been paid out so far and nobody seems to have any answers. The lack of political will to solve the MICA nightmare for thousands of traumatised Donegal homeowners was hammered home in the public to the public reps at the information meeting in Rye. If the political will was there, this would have been done quickly. All the homeowners need to work together in every way to keep the pressure on, was just some of the commentary from Lisa Hone there. More on the front of and inside that paper today, of course. The Donegal News talks of an unprecedented demand at food bank facility. We covered this a few months ago, or variations of this story a couple of months ago. Things have not improved. In fact, they perhaps have worsened. Let's read on. With the cost of living crisis pushing up demand, Letterkenny Food Bank has been forced to reduce its handout frequency. The registered charity is warned of its concerns for this coming winter amid a 33% surge in the number of people it has supported in the last 6 months. Such has been the pressure on the Market Square-based charity. It's been left with no alternatives but to decrease the frequency of food to families reaching out to them once every 4 weeks because it does not have enough food to sustain a three-week rotation. That's how bad it is. And the problem is too, food banks would have relied on people out doing their shop as well, of course, and picking up a few extra bits and dropping them off. But everyone's feeling the squeeze now. Everyone has saw the weekly shop or the bits and bobs go through the roof, or that's how it feels anyway. The Donegal Democrat, a West Donegal pensioner, has appeared in court charged with numerous alleged sexual offences. The accused man cannot be named to protect the identity of his alleged victims. Detective Garda Eugene Organ told Falkara District Court that he arrested the man at 9 a.m. this morning at Main Street in Milford. When the charges were put to the accused, he made no reply. The man is charged with a number of alleged instances, including indecent assault and sexual assault. The Derry News this morning, their lead story, our patients deserve better. Strike action, wholly unprecedented in the health and social care sector, is taking place across the north, including Derry. Health and social care professionals from Unison, Unite, NIPSA, the GMB, Royal College of Midwives, and on it goes and on it goes. They'll be on the picket line today and Friday. Mary Little, Unison's Foyil Joint Branch Secretary for Health, said her union is striking for better pay there. On to the Nationals now. We'll start with the Irish Daily Mail for a change. And any of you on social media or having watched the news will have seen the scenes outside the Dáil yesterday. About 200 to 300 people. And it was a well-organised protest. Well, well-organised, sorry, well-publicised across various social media platforms, Telegram, X, Twitter, and Facebook, and so on and so forth, to call people to the Dáil to welcome home, if you wouldn't quite put it like that, but you know what I mean, to welcome back TDs and senators returning after their summer recess. But it got boisterous. It got a wee bit violent too. There was pushing and shoving. Some awful things being said and shouted. And there were gallows there with various effigies of elected public representatives, effectively saying, you know, hang them. Michael Healy-Ray, who we'll speak to a little later on in the programme, he was being escorted by guards. He was jostled and insulted. His main crime, because he would be a bit of a, I suppose, someone that's normally quite protest-friendly, let me put it like that. But I believe he's housing Ukrainian refugees, and that was enough for him to be subjected to that abuse. 13 people in total were arrested. When you watch on, I think it's done whatever the cause is or whatever the campaign is, and it wasn't really quite clear to me yesterday what it was about, really. There was a lot of shouting and stuff. I don't know what it was. It was anger towards maybe the elected representatives, but it wasn't just they that were subject to abuse. Anyone going into the Dáil was. But it wasn't really articulated very well from what I could see, what the message was. You know, what is the campaign? What do they want? What needs changing? And also, I think it's expedited any argument for hate speech because of some of the stuff that was being said. We are going to see now more restrictions in terms of protests outside Dáil. So the way it was conducted, I think, has been incredibly counterintuitive. And what you'll see now, the next protest that's called, you might not even get a fraction of those, the amount of people there because of the perceived or reality of the toxicity of the situation. Did you watch on? What do you think? 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, or give us a call on 07491 25,000, as I say. Michael Healy-Ray will be on the show a little later on to talk of his experience. But reading on the article here, independent Kerry TD Michael Healy-Ray was jostled and jeered by protesters yesterday as the Dáil returned after the summer recess, with politicians from across the spectrum condemning the protest outside the Oireachtas. Later in the day, Gardaí had to form a barricade to allow a convoy of politicians to leave in their cars from the Merrion Street entrance. Around 200 protesters gathered outside as politicians returned from the summer recess. Gardaí confirmed 13 arrests were made during a day of protest that saw demonstrators block entrances and display mock gallows. Mr. Healy-Ray said, "I come to Dublin to represent the good people of the country. Nothing will ever deter me from doing my job," he added. "I've no issue with protesting, never have, never will. But you can see the videos circulating and judge for yourself if that behaviour and use of language is acceptable." And as I say, there was, you know, I mean, we're not made of sugar either, but I mean, there was some really, really strong stuff. The gallows too. It's just not a good look. But anyway, what do you think out there? 086 60 25,000. An issue, obviously, that's come up on this show on numerous occasions is e-cigarettes. There's an update on it in the Irish Independent, so I thought I'd bring it to you. Disposable vapes will be banned as part of a further crackdown on e-cigarettes, including curbs on flavours and advertising. If you go into a shop, you'll see often there's a screen behind the counter and it's all very fancy advertising, all really sexy. The products all look really sexy, you know, bubblegum flavour, all different types of flavours. Naturally, you know, that's not going to, it does nothing for me. Do you know what I mean? I'm not going to go, "Oh, right, I need one of them in my life." But if you're 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, though they may not be targeted at that cohort. It's certainly the cohort that might be attracted to such advertising. It's interesting, a lot of the screens are actually shaped like the same dimensions as a phone screen, which I think is quite interesting. They kind of look like TikTok ads. It's clever marketing, but unfortunately it's young people that's getting addicted to these products. The government earlier this year moved to ban the sale of vapes to children, and Health Minister Stephen Donnelly has now said he wants to ban single-use e-cigs. Earlier this week, Fianna Fáil TD Paul McAuliffe called for disposable vapes to be banned altogether by government due to the environmental impact. Mr. Donnelly said he is now planning a second piece of legislation to further clamp down on vapes, which would curb flavours and where they're advertised in shops. I fully support this policy, Mr. Donnelly told the Irish Independent. But are any of you out there now concerned? And I know it's, we can't be with our children all the time, and some of us, you know, might find that our young people are addicted to these things now. And some of them have really quite high nicotine levels. If they become hard to get, like, what are you going to do? Are you going to go into a vape shop and get a non-disposable, reusable vape for them? Are you going to hope they go cold turkey? Like, it does create a problem, because if these products aren't there, there's a lot of people that actually really are quite dependent on them. Young people, adults can, you know, plough their own path and find their own way. But I wonder, are any of you out there concerned as to what you will do with your child's nicotine addiction if they've developed one? And lots of young people are using them. If they aren't freely available in these shops, you either have to buy them for them or come up with an alternative, nicotine patches. Like, what are we going to do? What, there is going to be hundreds of thousands of young people who are going to have a dependency on nicotine. Well, tens of thousands, let's be more conservative. Tens of thousands of young people with a nicotine dependency. And what are we going to do about that? It's a really strong addiction. The Irish Times tells us that up to 30 care homes could face criminal investigations depending on the results of a Garda inquiry into the death of a woman in a residential home during the COVID-19 pandemic in 2021. Garda are examining the care received by the woman in a County Cork home in the period leading up to her death, which occurred during one of the worst periods of the pandemic. Sources have confirmed to this paper the case is being investigated as potential gross negligence manslaughter. The care home in question saw a large number of fatalities in the first 18 months of the pandemic, which began in early 2020. The Irish Times understands the investigation has been ongoing for a significant period of time and that a large number of interviews have taken place, including with relatives and staff. A file on the case is due to go to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution very shortly and it'll make a final decision on what, if any, charges are brought. And there might be a few follow-on cases there, no doubt, if that does come to pass. The Farmers' Journal's out today. Weanlings up €140 a head. Weanling prices have reached a new high this week, with Irish Farmers Journal Markbids data showing a €140 a head rise in the bull prices compared to the last year. Mart managers nationwide report a significant lift in demand among store producers, finishers and weaning exporters. And there's also some images from the ploughing championships. It's a wet, muddy mess. But people in the picture look like they're having fun. There was a survey of taxpayers about whether or not they want to see the licence fee discontinued. Now, I don't know how the question was phrased, and we'll tease it as we go through this. The bottom line is that if they get rid of this licence fee, they are introducing something else. There's not going to be a system whereby they get rid of the licence fee and there's no public contribution to public service broadcasting, in inverted commas. So whether people like this licence fee or not, if it's going, it's going to be replaced by something. And that is a fact. And you won't get a political party that will propose otherwise, certainly not one of the mainstream parties. So people should realise that if they get rid of this, they're getting something else. Over 60% of people want the TV licence fee to be scrapped, according to a new pre-budget survey. It found that more than 6 in 10 want the €160 charge axed, while 1 in 5 claim there's no need for public service broadcasting. 3 in 4 would not support a move to appoint revenue as collectors of the TV licence. Well, you see, that's the alternative. The findings come from the TaxBack Taxpayer Pre-Budget 2024 survey that polled 2,000 taxpayers nationwide. Okay, let us go to the Sun now. You heard yesterday Sinn Féin's finance spokesperson, Piers Doherty, on this programme calling for mortgage interest relief, a scheme for homeowners. Well, ministers last night shot down Sinn Féin's call for such a scheme. Meanwhile, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Tánaiste Micheál Martin and Green Party leader Eamon Ryan ditched the Dáil on its first day back after summer to attend a UN summit in New York. Lovely little impact on the environment that trip was, all three of them over in New York. I wonder, did they all fly in the same plane? The government leader's absence left Fine Gael's Simon Coveney to defend the coalition as they came under pressure over the housing crisis and the cost of living. Sinn Féin last night tabled a motion in the Dáil calling for the introduction of time-limited mortgage interest relief schemes to help hard-pressed families. And what we see just in terms of international travel and what have you. You know, I mean, obviously, I think most of us accept we have a problem. We have to do something. But if you, like, there's always a reason why the powers that be or rich people can do stuff like fly around on jets. Because they, well, we have to fly. How else are we going to get to America to, how else are we going to get to America to attend this important UN conference? We have to fly in a jet. So, you know, that's the way it is. But we could all do that. Like, you know, I want to go on holiday. Well, how am I going to go on holiday? I have to fly in a jet, don't we? So whilst the leaders and the rich continue to be able to justify doing stuff like that, but at the same time telling us maybe we shouldn't, now, we're all in the same boat. They're no different to us. There's always an excuse as to do it. I would love to cycle to work, but I can't. I have to take a car because I live too far away from it. You know what I mean? They need to go to America. They can't paddle there. They have to fly. You know, we're all in the same boat here. But they get away. They get away with it more than we might. And a record-breaking wellychuck at the Ploughing Championships. Almost 1,000 revelers, as they're described here, put their best foot forward yesterday as they set a new welly-throwing record at the National Ploughing Championships. In the muddied field of County Leash, 995 participants eclipsed the efforts of the 792 people who set the previous best in England in 2018. Why don't we all get together? We'll meet in the town park in Letterkenny or somewhere and bring a welly with us. We can get 1,000 of us together. We'll get into the Guinness Book of World Records. 995 is not a big deal. We can break that, can't we? Right, okay. Everyone paid a fiver. You'd create $5,000 for charity. Anyway, that is a look through the papers today. We've got loads of people to talk to, loads of people to interview. Just to remind you that if you want to send in a message to us, WhatsApp or text 086 60 25000, and feel free to set the ball rolling on voice messages as well if you want that played out. And you can call us 210-7491-25000. Martina Porter is Quality and Patient Safety Manager with Letterkenny University Hospital. Good morning to you, Martina.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you very much for joining us. Right, Martina, is yours a new post or is it a new sort of initiative we're talking about, or perhaps both?
Well, no, my role isn't a new. I'm new in the role, fairly new.
Understood.
In the role, but it's not a new role as such. But so it's but this is kind of us looking at World Patient Safety Day, which is a global initiative. So we wanted to do something locally to mark World Patient Safety Day.
Okay.
From a quality and patient safety perspective. So what we wanted to do here was the theme this year for World Patient Safety Day was empowering and engaging patients to improve patient safety, and I suppose elevating the voice of patients. And this is something that we've been looking at since, you know, We've implemented a few different initiatives since I've come into post. We have introduced patient feedback forms where patients can fill out a questionnaire and make suggestions for service improvement. And we're setting up a patient and family experience group as well. So it's in keeping with the themes of our national patient safety strategy. But what we wanted to do was introduce something that brings that information to the bedside for the patients. So to empower and engage patients, patients need, I suppose, to have the knowledge and, I suppose, information to be able to do that. So what we decided to do was design a bedside poster. To look at what information we would put on that poster, you know, we did like an analysis of all of our most commonly reported maybe patient safety incidents and look at themes and what the causes were. And on this poster is, you know, top tips for patients on what they can do and how they can engage with us to improve safety. So there's information there in relation to medication safety, falls prevention, protecting personal property and items, you know, advice on quitting smoking. And there's QR codes there as well that takes, you know, patients out to other websites where they can get more information if they wish to avail of that. So we have updated our patient information booklet as well. And we have hard copies that we can give out as well to patients, but there's a QR code there as well. It's available online if people would prefer to access it online. And there's a wealth of information now that's going to be available right there at the bedside for people. But I suppose more importantly, to build on the patient engagement piece, and as part of designing this, we went to the Patient for Patient Safety Ireland group, which is a national network of people that are really focused as patients on patient safety. So they were instrumental in helping us put this poster together for it to be user friendly and contain the appropriate information.
And how
so they've
you,
been heavily involved.
Yeah, and Martina, how do you engage patients who maybe older or perhaps who can't read very well or feel so sick and down that they don't want to engage? You know, how do you make sure that they're polled as well?
Well, engagement is entirely optional here, you know, and if patients feel they don't want to engage, there's absolutely no obligation on anyone whatsoever.
No, but Emma, how do you include that? I understand but, that Martin, people have a choice. How do you include everybody?
Well, I suppose it's open to patients and families. So what we're saying is patient and families. So a patient may themselves decide they don't want to, but they may want a family member to engage on their behalf. And that's absolutely fine as well. And on our forms, you know, it is, you know, if it's a patient that completes it or if it's a family member, you know, so that we know if it's a patient or if it's a family member that's providing us with the information, and it's all accepted. And it's a patient and family experience user group as well. So it's very inclusive of patients and their families.
So if there's a trend, Martina, how is that acted on? So say, for instance, something pops up, two or three. I don't want to give examples because I don't really know any that might fit what we're talking of. But say there's a trend of a number of patients highlight the same thing. How do you act on that?
So we have a few different ways of feeding back. And I suppose it's really important because it's on this poster as well, where we're inviting feedback from people. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we go around and empty the suggestion boxes and we analyse the feedback, and we feedback A, to the department and the staff so that they can action, and B, I feedback in my report, I report back into the hospital, various hospital committees. So say, for example, if a patient was to give feedback about, and I'm just using this as an example, say about food or snacks or, you know, availability or quality or whatever, then I would feed that back into the appropriate committees, mm-hmm. you know, as well for decision and action. But it goes back to the departments and the teams as well. So we do a lot of analysis and we do a lot of reporting back. And, you know, then it's quality improvements then and deciding what we're going to do to improve on that and build on that moving forward. But I think it's very important to say as part of this poster as well, there is an invitation on there for patients if they wish to feedback by completing out a form, or equally there is a code, that QR code that'll mm-hmm. take them to the Your Service, Your Say, where that's the where they can do that online if they wish to leave a comment or feedback online, and equally an invitation if people wish to join our patient and family experience group, that they can do that as well and be part of that group as well, that, you know, where we can all work together collaboratively, you know,
and
to drive service improvement.
Is it ongoing? In other words, you don't collate this information for 2 or 3 months and then act on it, or perhaps you do?
This is something that I do monthly.
Yeah.
And then I trend analysis from month to month. So, you know, it's quite comprehensive.
Mm-hmm. And has it been going long enough where you can give us an example of something that was flagged and then acted on and improved on?
Well, I can't get into specific examples, I suppose, at the minute, because, it's going off into another piece of work that we're doing here at the moment. But I suppose it's important to say that we get the feedback, that we can act on. And there has been a huge amount of, there's been a huge amount of actions, and it is something that we are actively engaged with. When we get our patient and family experience user group up and running, we hope that it'll even gather more momentum, in that there'll be direct involvement there and then feeding back through the group as well to improve services as well.
Right. And I'm just trying to phrase this in a way, Martina, that without getting into stuff, but just to I mean, there are certain issues with the hospital that we talk about here extensively in terms of, you know, staffing and things like, there's some things surveys like this can't affect, and then there are other things that they can. So in other words, presumably, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, this is patient engagement to improve experiences where it's possible to do so with minor changes. I mean, obviously it's not separate to and it's part of, but this is not part of the sort of necessarily the big issues that people would be familiar with. This is the patient inpatient experiences that can be tailored for on a sort of ongoing basis.
Exactly. And I suppose, Greg, this is sowing the seeds. Like, this is in its infancy. We're really just getting this off the ground. We started the questionnaire in January. We're getting some feedback, but it's gathering that momentum. We're hoping with this poster now, patients will feel more able to engage as well, and especially when we get this group up and running. And we have more projects that's going to be more patient and family centred as well, and patient and family focused, where it's going to be really, you know, I suppose service improvements will be driven with that collaboration in mind, you know. Mm-hmm. So I suppose we have a few different things, a few different strands through which we're going to try and achieve this. Okay. You know, and I suppose the poster is a kind of first step to, you know, gathering that momentum, you know. So we have the questionnaires, you know, and they're being filled out, but, you know, it's not a consistent approach at the moment. There's not a consistency at the moment because people don't often know they're there, mm-hmm. or people don't know where to go. Information will be there at the bedside now, so people will know that the poster's there and there's the suggestion box if you wish to do that.
And Martina, in wards and rooms? It's not in the ED, for an example. This is specifically for people.
This is going to be everywhere throughout the hospital.
Okay, right. All right, okay. Right, Martina, thank you very much. People going in can keep an eye out for those. I do appreciate your time this morning. Martina Porter there, Quality and Patient Safety Manager at Letterkenny University Hospital. Okay, I've chatted to people over the summer and some people thought new laws were in place as it relates to quad bikes and others weren't aware that they were to change at all. But the reality is that there are new and updated quad bike laws coming into effect on the 20th of November. So effectively 2 months from today. Pat Griffin is Senior Inspector with the Health and Safety Authority. I suppose, Pat, we'll begin with what changes are taking place in relation to quad bike usage?
Good morning, Greg, and I'm down here at the Ploughing Championships for the third day, and we're demonstrating these quad bikes and risks around tractors and quad bikes here at the championships. The regulations, as you say, come into effect on the 20th of November, and they're quite simple. It'll require anyone operating a quad bike that's in any sector, whether it's in construction, farming, quarrying, forestry, wherever the quad bike is used, the operator must have training and they must wear a helmet. So they're the two simple requirements, and we're glad to see that there is starting to be an uptake in the training, mm-hmm. and we really encourage people to comply with these regulations.
Is it certified training? So say, for instance, if I had a quad and I want to use it legally on the 20th of November, how do I complete this training?
You must get the training from a registered training provider, so it must be certified training. It can't be just a father teaching the son or vice versa. It has to be a registered training provider and there must be certified training. And there's lots of trainers around the country. You know, trainers are registered with QQI, Lantra, City and Guild, and we would encourage farmers to go out and find the trainer in your locality and get that training done.
And is it a test? In other words, is it just a run-through of health and safety?
Well, the training is for an experienced rider, and there's many, many experienced people out there on quads. It'll be a one-day training period. For an inexperienced person, it'll be 2 days, and it won't be two consecutive days. It'll be 2 days separated by some time where the operator has some time to practice. At the end of either training courses, there'll be an assessment. There's a very short, simple written assessment, and then there's a practical assessment, where the trainer will assess the competence of the operator to fulfill certain tasks in the training. So it is practical, and it's an assessment done by the trainer. And if he feels your competence and have been trained properly, he will give you the certificate.
I presume, I could be wrong, but I presume when we talk about training being obligatory and the wearing of a helmet being obligatory, we're talking about on public roads.
No, it's anywhere. So whether you're operating the tractor or the quad bike on your farm, whether it's been operated in a quarry, on a construction site, in a factory, on a forestry, it's not just on the public road. And I think some people have got that impression. Though this training is wherever you operate your quad bike.
And so effectively, if you own a quad bike, you're going to have training and a helmet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the importance of the helmet can't be overemphasized. There has been 10 fatalities in the last 10 years from quad bikes. And when you think of the number of quad bikes in the country, that's a very, very high number. It actually makes the quad bike the most dangerous piece of equipment that a farmer can use. They're a very useful piece of equipment, and they're very, very simple to operate, but they're also very, very simple to overturn and get a serious injury or fatality from if you're not trained properly on how to use them.
So I presume Ungoddish Eochaná will enforce on the public highways as they do. How will these measures be enforced on private property?
Well, the HSA inspectors will go and do inspections of whatever sector it is, whether it's in construction or farming. If the inspector goes in and he finds a quad bike at the place of work, then he will ask the person who is operating the quad bike for their training certificate. And that's how it will be enforced. If they don't have training, if they don't have a training certificate, we will take action. The other element is we will ask them where their helmet is. And if they don't have a helmet, we will prohibit the use of the quad bike. But, you know, it absolutely makes sense that people wear a helmet. I mean, who these days would actually drive a car without a seatbelt? People should not be operating a quad bike now without a helmet. The vast majority of fatalities and serious life-changing injuries from a quad bike overturn are head injuries. And many of the deaths that have been caused by quad bikes would have been prevented if people were wearing their helmet.
Yeah, and it's not hard to see how that will happen. It's a heavy vehicle, but they are easy to overturn. And just with the nature of them, when you come off them, you're generally not too far away from the quad when that happens. And it can easily go over on top of you or whatever it might be. Or you could be thrown from it and smack your head off a rock or something either way. But it's not hard to see the argument for it. Is it a bit... Do you think it's a bit over the top, though? Or do you think it's too far-reaching going on people's private property... insisting that they...
No, not at all. As we all know, we can't turn back the clock. And, I mean, there are people today that have suffered, family members that have suffered, they've had fatalities and they've had serious life-changing injuries. And our sympathies go out to these families. But you can't turn back the clock. And all these families would turn back the clock. They would, you know, do things differently. They would... certainly insist on helmets and training, and I'm sure they would agree with this approach.
All right. So, two more questions, if you don't mind, Pat. Yeah. From what age can you get this training?
Yeah, well, all the quad manufacturers will specify the age on the quad, and they all specify you must be 16 years and over to operate a quad bike.
So, really, we're saying here, Pat, effectively going forward. It's illegal for anyone under the age of 16, regardless of the size of the quad, to be on a quad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In a work environment. This is for workplace legislation. So if a person is operating a quad for work, then you must have training and you must be a person of over 16. There are other quad bikes that are not as big and not as strong that are used for recreation. They're not within these regulations. They're for recreation.
How long does the cert last for?
It's a lifetime cert. It's only once off training. Once you do this training, you're trained and you're good to go for life. And that is the good part. I mean, once you know this training and learn how to do active riding on a quad bike, and that's the critical thing, that people practice active riding. You'll notice that most quad bikes have a very, very big seat. Some people think that's for carrying passengers. It's not. It's actually for moving your body weight to keep the stability of the quad. So if you're going up a steep hill, you slide your body forward, and actually you could even have to lean over the handlebars going up a slope. And going down the slope, you have to place your body weight at the very back of the seat to keep stability. And moving left and right when you're taking corners. So that seat is that size to practice active riding. So, you know, that's what you learn in this training. And you also learn how to maintain it and make sure that the tire pressure is correct.
How are we differentiating, other than where it's being operated, just to be clear, because there could be some confusion, how are you differentiating between a work quad, in inverted commas, and a recreational quad?
if someone is doing work with their quad, that's work activity.
Okay.
And we will enforce it then. That's the simple rule.
Okay. Right. Okay. It comes into effect from November 20th. Pat Griffin, Senior Inspector with the Health and Safety Authority. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks very much, Greg, for
okay,
covering
take
me.
Care. Bye-bye. 086 60 25,000. WhatsApps and text 086 60 25,000. A caller says the hospital is in crisis because of lack of staff, and this is the answer they come up with. What a waste of money. Let's make a better effort to put money into real services needed as opposed to those box-ticking exercises. I kind of addressed the overall problems and then the things that can be addressed sort of within that, and I think that's what that survey is about. But listen, if you're in the hospital, don't fill it out. That would be your view, I presume. As a staff member working in the hospital, I definitely see efforts to improve care for our patients. I commend Martina Porter on her efforts. Thank you very much indeed for that. Nice to get some positive feedback as well. Morning, Greg. Just heard you mention protests at the Dáil yesterday. I'm not a fan of protests, but there comes a time when enough is enough. And by that I mean when you struggle to put your children through college without any help from the government, when those children work hard at college and promise to pay you back when they get a job. Those children are now well-educated young people, but despite their hard work and reasonable good job, they can't and probably may never be able to afford a home. They can't get access to a GP because all practitioners are full and apparently not taking new patients. Their promise of paying their parents back has gone out the window, as they're now struggling, just like we were to send them to college. This may sound like a rant, but this is what our great young Irish people are going through. This is why I think protests are never more needed, but keep them organised and peaceful. Protesting is an essential form of democracy. People have to protest. People should protest when they need to. That's not the issue here. The issue is the nature of the protest. I didn't see any young people at that protest yesterday, to be honest with you. Not that that matters, but those that are affected by this, like you say you are. And it's the gallows, it's the pushing, it's the language. It's the nature of the protest, not the protest itself, which we're discussing. And I think I would hope we never get to a point where anyone would come out and say there shouldn't be protests. Greg, these protests are just the beginning. Beginning of what, though? People are no longer angry. They're furious. Main issue being rampant uncontrolled immigration, followed by cost of living and a complete breakdown in trust between the public and the political class. Seeing elected reps scooping massive amounts of money for housing immigrants while the rest of us get crucified with €1,200 a month rents for one-bed flats is sickening. Hate speech laws being brought in to protect politicians, not the immigrants. I understand where you're coming from. A lot of people may well feel the same. But why do people, where is this when it comes to an election? I mean, the council elections are coming up. Will that view be reflected in those? Probably not. General election not too long thereafter. Will, up until now, people that stand opposed to migration and things like that often struggle to get a handful of votes. If you know what I'm saying. Right, okay, I have to take a very quick break. Then we're going to be speaking to the mother of a young girl who's a spina bifida patient. Now, parents have lost trust and faith amid a long-running national scandal regarding the care and treatment of their children. Co-founder of the Scoliosis Advocacy Network, Claire Cahill, has said her comments come after the publication by Children's Health Ireland of the internal and external reviews into spinal surgery for patients with spina bifida at Temple Street Children's Hospital in Dublin between 2019 and 2022. Sinead is the mother of Michaela, who is a spina bifida patient and who had an operation 5 years ago in Liverpool and joins us now. Hi, Sinead. Thank you for your time today.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. Now, you believe, do you not, that the scope of any review needs to be widened much greater. What's the background to those views?
I suppose the background is that we were aware from Michaela was about maybe 5-6 months old that she was going to need, further surgeries. They recommended that they would do it around 18 months. But by that stage, Michaela was actually showing movement that they really hadn't expected her to have. And then her team were willing to wait till she was 4 and see how she was at that stage. And we were happy with that. But I suppose as time went on, Michaela went downhill quite fast. It came to a point when she was 7 that she was losing the power to walk. She was given a wheelchair. And while she could still walk, the distances she could do were just getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And her feet were becoming more clubbed. Her kidneys were under pressure. And I knew she needed the surgery. Obviously, the country wasn't in a good shape at the time economically. Yeah. And long story short, the team that she'd been with since birth wouldn't do it. They said, you just have to accept that it's too risky. We were told the risk of paralysis with the surgery was 50-50 mm-hmm. and that there was a huge risk greater than that of hydrocephalus.
So what did they suggest then in the absence of them doing the operation? What would have been the treatment or the outcome for Michaela?
Get her used to the wheelchair were the exact words that I was told. Get her used to it. I was told by somebody, this is the will of God. And I didn't buy that. I got to know some other parents mm-hmm. who had the same issue and needed the same surgery. And long story short, they were all told the same risks. But this didn't add up to me. Not that I'm a genius when it comes to medical stuff. I wish I'd never had to deal with any of it, to be perfectly honest. But I figured it can't be the same risk for somebody who has feeling than somebody who hasn't feeling. So mm-hmm. I looked for opinions abroad. I got quite a few of them, and I was absolutely hell-bent, for want of a better term, that Michaela was getting this surgery. Dublin wouldn't do it. They wouldn't put her on a waiting list, which meant that I couldn't access the treatment abroad scheme. I became aware of another scheme that Michaela could possibly have accessed, but the surgeon in Dublin wouldn't sign the form. Mm-hmm. Now, I looked for interventions from so many places, and I have to commend, you know, the TDs in the county here, and this was in my native Monaghan-Cavan, mm-hmm. where they all tried to see if there was something could be done. Michaela's paediatrician in Letterkenny was fantastic, tried to make representation. They wouldn't sign the form.
So effectively, not only were they refusing to do the treatment here, effectively, they were blocking you progressing her treatment in Britain.
100%. And I felt profusely intimidated for many, 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 many months by different things that happened, which I won't outline now.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to obviously prejudice any review, because this review is going to take place. If it's the last thing I ever do, it's going to have to be, the scope is going to have to be widened. You know, there are so many children that I know from Michaela was born or that were born after her that are waiting on surgeries. You know, we've very close friends that I've sat and I've watched on different news channels, and I've heard them on the radio, and I can only cry, and that's just the God's honest truth, because I know what they're going through. Mm-hmm. I've been there. I know what it's like to be waiting for the surgery. I am so lucky that we've had it. But I suppose there are so many of those families that are living in areas that don't have the backup that we have. They're not in the rural location. And I'm like a broken record ever since Michaela got her surgery, saying it takes a village, it takes a county or two counties in our case.
To make sure I get all elements of this before the news, Dublin says there was a 50% chance of paralysis. Liverpool, it was 2%.
Yes.
How did you then manage to get Michaela treated in Liverpool? Were you able to do it publicly, or did you have to do it privately?
No, we had to do it completely privately.
Wow.
We still attend Liverpool a few times a year as private patients. So we have to pay everything, all our costs, everything, you know, has to be. And we're happy to do that because she gets the care that she needs there. Unfortunately, we have to also attend Temple Street, because if we don't do that, Michaela can't transition to adult services.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
So I can't take her off.
Michaela's not on the list. So when we talk about long waiting lists, Michaela never got onto that list. How many other children have their parents have been told that and have watched their child deteriorate and have to get used to life in a wheelchair? That's very, very worrying. That's very worrying that the outcome
it,
for
it
people.
Is hugely, yeah.
Right, okay.
I suppose one other thing I would say that while, you know, the, you know, politicians and all the rest, people in power are saying that we can, you know, send some of these people abroad, I absolutely wholeheartedly agree with that. But the element of it where the surgeons have to sign the paperwork, that needs to be taken out of it. If a case can be made by the surgeon abroad to verify why it's doable, we're entitled to second opinion, and the effort to get that should never be frustrated as it was in our case. And the outcome is drastically different for Michaela having had this surgery than it is for a lot of children in Ireland. That's of huge concern.
If you hadn't done what you had done, what would Michaela's situation be like compared to what it actually is like?
It's very hard to not get upset when I think of this. I know Michaela would be in a wheelchair. I know she, you know, would have had to get probably a kidney by now. We were told by 12, and she's now 13. I honestly don't think Michaela would be alive had I let that team operate on Michaela. And that's the truth. So it's really disturbing to think about. But it's more disturbing to think about the families that are in this predicament now. And God, how do they eat, sleep and function? Mm. You know, I know I struggled with all of that before her surgery. It's hell on earth, like, for people in that situation. That there's no other term for it. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry. It wasn't my intention to upset you, but I just wanted
you're very good. I'm used to talking to GA with you, not this.
I just wanted us to get a full understanding of it, Sinead. You know yourself.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
All right, fair play
that.
To you and your resilience and fight. And I just feel so... I just worry if there's others listening that took the 50-50 chance of paralysis for granted and trusted, and how they might feel now. Sinead, listen, thanks for that.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Take care.
You too.
Bye now.